The Scientology documentary is Tom Cruise's answer. In honor of Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, what is your least favorite Tom Cruise movie?
I like it when I fail to read the joke in the doc and then it surprises me and I get to laugh live. I'm Katie Rich and I'm going with The Last Samurai because come on, what was up with that?
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and thanks to YouTube, I have no need of rewatching Legend in its entirety.
I'm Matt Patches and fuck Top Gun.
Okay. Just a reminder that if they ever do make Top Gun 2, Matt Patches has to eat his shoe.
Well, yes.
Fuck Top Gun 2 also.
I don't know who that bet is with, but I remember that it's a thing. I'm David Ehrlich, and my choice is Rock of Ages. A part of me is still sitting in the corner seat of that movie theater, which strangely had corners, desperately willing to get out. But I did not get out because that movie went on.
You wish Tom Cruise was singing your butt.
Of Tom Cruise singing into Malin Ackerman's butthole. Ugh.
It went on and on like Don't Stop Believin', maybe?
Exactly.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 141 for Tuesday, October 18th. On this day in 1967 was the release of Walt Disney's The Jungle Book. Wait, I thought that came out in April of this year. Oh, you mean the original Jungle Book that's been erased by history by the new one.
You can never see it again. It's in the Disney vault.
Nope.
Well, it might actually
be in the Disney vault.
There's a good 40% of it that was just repurposed to make Robin Hood. So just watch Robin Hood and you'll see them dance in the exact same way and do a lot of other stuff the same way too.
We'll have to do an episode in the future about why we should not so blithely tolerate this constant stream of Disney remakes. But
maybe after we see Ewan McGregor do a French accent as a talking candlestick.
Perhaps.
It seems like a good time.
Beauty and the Beast may be a reckoning for us all.
We have to get through the election first. Let's save our reckoning. Speaking of the election, I hear we have some politically themed reviews after you guys. I don't know what you did last week, but you got political, I hear, after
We had a very reasoned conversation. We had a level-headed conversation about optics.
Well, let's find out how it was taken. It felt level-headed from the inside.
Father of Matt Patches was a fan of our conversation, and that's really all that matters. So
great endorsement.
I am perfectly fine with the talk that we had. But Lawrence of Alabama may not be. Movie fan that is not a liberal lamb, says Lawrence of Alabama, who gives us 3 stars. Can you be a fan of film and film talk without being 100 against a certain party? 100 against a certain party. That's a lot against. Apparently not according to this cast and many others. I mean, enough already. We get it. You're, no apostrophe, so much better than those who have different political beliefs. I just want to hear talk about film, not ill-informed political banter that just continues the average Hollywood agenda. I don't mind you feeling the need to explain that you love a certain policy. However, when you call others who are in contrast ignorant or terrible for the country, you just sound like another tool. I get that you need others to create in order to have a job, but don't you want to have one original point? One thing that is your opinion and not just another ripple caused by the Hollywood rock of liberal thought? I happen to be able to see both sides have some points. Very strange grammar. I'm struggling here. I usually blitz right through these, but this one is throwing me. I really would concede that even the Democrats care about the country, but having a candidate like Hillary isn't really a good pass to call Trump anything but a better alternative. Surely your liberal party, and I assume I'm right for most hosts and viewers of this cast, could concede that you sure picked a pile of $@IT to go against a load of it. Anyway, enjoy the show. Just stick to talking about the hard work of others. Leave the actual creative process to those who can. I will admit again that I struggled with a lot of this review. I thank you very much, Lawrence of Alabama, for leaving it, I should say. The sentence structuring, the grammar, it was an adventure. It was hard to know what was going to happen next, and I appreciate that to a certain degree.
You're an elitist pick,
and,
David.
And I like your name, Lawrence of Alabama.
Yeah, so we should
leave the creating to him. He's pretty good at it.
I would say that as much as that point vexes me a little bit, the idea that he's railing against us for not being creative, I'm not sure if I see the through line. I will say, having read or skimmed over Lawrence of Alabama's other reviews that he has read for podcasts, that they're predominantly for gaming podcasts, and we seem to be one of the only movie podcasts that he took the time to to shout out and listen to.
Sweet.
So thank you very much for that, Lawrence of Alabama.
Thanks.
Enjoy your listening. We also have a review from Rod24601.
Is says, this Rod additional... Patches?
I don't think so. Rod Patches has already left us a review. An additional reason to listen to Fighting in the War Room. Seeing the election through the perspective of cinema is a great way to explain what we are seeing through a lens that we are familiar with, yet for most of us, don't appreciate. Whether you're the left or right, we could all use an education now and then. Well, takes all kinds.
That was definitely my dad. That was definitely my dad. 24601 is Jean Valjean's number.
Wait, is this the first time Rod Patches has left us a review?
Probably, other people have updated their reviews, so maybe this is an update.
Yeah, maybe he left. Maybe he dropped his iPhone.
Maybe. Well, thank you, Rod Patches. I will just a shout out to Lenny Turtletob, whose review we read last week about. I need to know: is David at Arthouse Trump? I may have teased this on the podcast last week, but you can now go on IndieWire and read an interview with the one and only true Arthouse Trump, who is in fact not myself, but a valiant member of our Air Force who lives in Las Vegas and has had tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and loves Nathaniel Dorsky. So what a world we live in. What a beautiful, terrible, unexpected
self-promoting world.
Well, exactly. You can leave us a review and we will discuss you in detail as we have all these people, even if you're not the parent of someone on this podcast. So keep leaving reviews. We enjoy them immensely.
Now I'm the king of the swingers, oh, the jungle VIP. I've reached the top and had to stop, and that's what's bothering me. I want to be a man cub.
Guys, I see that right on the dock we're discussing something called Shin Godzilla. I don't know if it is a game or a TV show or a comic book or anything.
You've never heard of
none of those. None of those things.
Shit, is it a movie? It's just a movie?
You missed it entirely.
Wow. So that's how uninformed I am. Someone tell me what Shin Godzilla is. And I'm not surprised at all that Dave is interested, but the rest of you, I'm curious.
Wow.
But Dave is famously into monster movies. That's his brand.
Because, yeah, that's right.
I thought you said David. I'm less offended now.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm interested to see. I know that David and Patches and I all saw Shin Godzilla in its limited release last week. Funimation brought over the Japanese Godzilla response to Gareth Edwards' American Godzilla. And it does a lot of cool things, I thought. I'm interested to hear what these other guys think, because I think I've been talking to people about Shin Godzilla whenever I possibly can and somehow missed these two.
It's animated?
No, it's in live action movie from Toho, the company that makes all the Godzilla movies. They're sort of reclaiming their Japanese side of the brand. And unlike the American Godzilla, which has sort of been positioned to be a monster brawler and is set up to fight King Kong down the way, Shin Godzilla goes back to the root Godzilla of using him as sort of a metaphor for unstoppable powers of some sort, which is totally why I enjoyed it. Outside of the fact that when I got to see it in a theater, everyone found it really funny and it was great. The first, 40 minutes of this movie are paced like, I think Veep is a good way to put it.
I think
but
it's
like
exactly
sort of a
like
political
Veep.
Satire.
It's not as funny
Patches.
As Veep. It's not as funny as Veep, but it's definitely as chaotic and it's all about bureaucracy, right? It's all about this massive force, which could be a metaphor for, you know, imploding power plants from the past, or maybe it's natural disasters. Whatever the case is,
this film is a direct response, as much as the original Godzilla was a direct response to the nuclear devastation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This film is a direct response to the 311 disaster
what's
in
the
Japan.
There?
Make no bones about it.
What's the dead giveaway there?
The uniforms, the blue uniforms, I think, visually, for me, was what did it.
I don't know if you need a visual clue that's that particular. I think the entire I mean, the movie, it's a very, I mean, we've all sort of buried the lead so far, which is that, at least to me, which is that this movie was written and directed by Hideaki Anno, who made Neon Genesis Evangelion.
That's not burying the lead. That's you're not answering my question. You're scoffing at my question. Why is it an obvious metaphor?
I'm going to get there. I'm going, just taking a back door. Hideaki Anno, I can't remember the analogy that I used in my review, but it's a very strange guy to hire to make a big blockbuster equivalent size movie. He is a singular filmmaker, as anyone who's seen Neon Genesis Evangelion could tell you. He is very much in his own head, very philosophical, and here he's very angry. I think he's channeling a lot of the anger that the Japanese people had towards their government in regards to the response of how the government handled the 3/11 disaster, the meltdown
of
Fukushima.
Although he made a giant monster movie before. He made a short film for Studio Ghibli about...
Sure.
Yeah, the giant warrior descends on Tokyo from Narciso, the Valley of the Wind. I think you can see that on Vimeo if you wanted to check that out.
I think that, like, he is not one to hide his... I don't think he knows how to make something that doesn't shine through with his feelings about whatever the subject might be at hand. And you can feel his rage, I feel, sublimating sort of through every shot of this film, which is, for those who complained about how little Godzilla is in Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, you will be very disappointed by this movie, which I think he's probably in even less. This is...
he's in more, but he has less to do.
He does very, very little. He just sort of walks and waddles. And there's a great... The way that the Godzilla in this film is introduced is, I think, to Patches, to your point, Dave, earlier, is actually very funny. And the whole thing, while not quite man in suit style effects, it definitely leans hard towards chintzy CG visuals, does have the same feel as those sort of mid-era Godzilla movies, not the Ishiro Honda 1954, but some of the stuff that was made in the middle. I do think it's a very angry response, not only just to how the government responded to the disaster, but also just the lack of preparedness of a country that has been burned once by this already and still puts themselves, because of bureaucracy, because of greed, because of selfishness, in another vulnerable position.
That's why,
to be fucked again.
That's why I don't think it's just an obvious metaphor for the 3/11 nuclear disaster, because later in the movie they need to call upon the U.S. to, like, help them bomb their own country. There's another, like, miserable aspect to this scenario that is completely removed from the disaster effort or the relief efforts from that one fallout. This seems to encompass so many problems that Japan has happened reacting to all sorts of disasters in their timeline.
Well, I mean, there's three beats to the movie based on each time that Godzilla's attacking or, you know, recharging and sort of giving them a chance to scramble. And the last one, the last pause, if you will, really takes a pivot away from some of the satire into more, like, thoughtful speaking to the culture. I think it felt like there were moments that were drawn out where, in comparison to how focused the rest of the movie was with its message, only made me think that, you know, debating, you know, why our main character got into politics in the first place probably says something more to somebody in Japan than it does to me. So for me, it sort of, like, slowed down, but it was interesting to see that, like, Godzilla evolves with this movie. So it's, like, doing quick cuts, it's doing montages of people pushing paper around to rock music, and Godzilla looks like a turkey for, like, the first 30 minutes of this movie, and my audience was having, like, a great time with it. By the time it gets down to, like, the really hardcore stuff about, like, the U.S. and Japan's intermingled relationship was good, but I think not necessarily as angled to a wider audience as the first part, or, like, just in general Godzilla movies usually are, which are usually about things just blowing up and getting destroyed. Like, even Godzilla 1985 had, like, a thing that flew around and shot Godzilla with, like, cadmium rockets just so we'd have something to watch while old Raymond Burr looked at a screen in a green room somewhere.
Not in my Godzilla, he didn't.
Well, I'm saying, in every time there's been a single attack Godzilla, there's only this movie and the original movie that uses it as a, like, just as a political threat and doesn't only revels in the destruction to what is like the minimum amount in comparison to something like Destroy All Monsters or, you know, the 90s movies, which were about, you know, crazy Japanese anime plots constructed so that the Godzilla could actually fight monsters with his hands. So it was really interesting to watch a Godzilla movie and be able to sort of, you know, re-plug into that part of my brain that's for foreign film and not the part of my brain that's for suit fighting.
You should know, Dave, that you recently rewatched like all the movies, right? I mean, you watched a shit ton of Godzilla in anticipation.
You just listed off a lot of Godzilla titles, like, with no effort at all. So I'm assuming you've watched them so much.
Dave wrote about every single Godzilla movie for me. It's a staggering effort,
where can you find that article?
Oh well, I wasn't going to shamelessly self promote, but that would be on Thrillist.com. Anyway,
that's
how could
Dave
you shamelessly self promote? Yeah, thank you for promoting me, Patches.
No problem. Well, the big thing reading that article for me was, and you pose this question. Can America do monster movies? Like, is Shin Godzilla the prime example of why Japan can make monster movies and America seems incapable, or Hollywood specifically?
Maybe. I mean, our monster movies aren't great at also being serious because I don't think our culture is great at taking them seriously. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when Universal comes around and tries to, you know, do more Americanized monsters. You know, we're talking about Tom Cruise. He's going to be a new mummy lead in some sort of Afghanistan-based mummy, maybe. So, I don't know. I don't really have hope. What I am hoping is that we could eventually do the Brawlers correctly, and that's nice that, you know, we've been trying recently, but, like, what we've been getting is Pacific Rim and Godzilla, which are enjoyable but aren't, like, great monster brawl cinema, which actually exists.
What's the latest on the Godzilla sequel? Is that happening? The Gareth Edwards Godzilla?
I think it's after he clears Rogue One, he's probably going to do that, is what I heard. But the plan is to do Kong Skull Island, Godzilla 2, Godzilla versus King Kong.
Ah. I'm gonna...
But if they need to, they'll bump it back.
Should I make my own shoe-eating bet that that never works out the way that you just described it?
You should.
Sure.
I don't know. I have a hard time seeing if they're putting it on ice for this long. I kind of forgot that there had been an American Godzilla that recently. I don't know. It doesn't seem like they're that serious about it.
Well, Star Wars has a way of stopping people from doing things. And, you know, you're either the Gareth Edwards and you got to stop and put all in your Godzilla movie, or you're Josh Trank and you disappear.
Whoa.
Star Wars. Well, I mean, I'm sure he's out there, but he hasn't come back yet.
Godzilla. Well, steer it back in the end here to Shin Godzilla.
Here's why I'm difficult. Shin Godzilla is great. It played in theaters. We're going to eventually get some sort of release, I'm assuming, through Funimation, but I don't know when that is. So I'd love to tell people to go see Shin Godzilla, but I don't think it's possible.
Did it play as a one-night only thing?
It's like one week only.
Mm.
But it'll come to iTunes. It will be out there. Do you think this is the beginning of a new era for Toho, Dave?
They've already greenlit Shin Godzilla 2 because it was so popular. I think it's the third most attended Japanese Godzilla movie of all time, which would be behind, I know, King Kong versus Godzilla and 1990s Mothra versus Godzilla. And then, so that what did well enough that we're going to have competing franchises. So Toho licensed to Legendary to do Godzilla, but that license allows them to also do their own Godzilla. Shin Godzilla, which translates to True Godzilla.
So basically, in the next few years, Japanese film Twitter is going to be like, oh, there are so many Godzilla movies coming out. And then there's going to be some other Japanese film blogger types who are going to be like, no, Godzilla movies are just like Westerns, you know, they come and go. And then they're going to battle on Twitter, just like Kaiju.
Just like Godzilla and Mothra.
Exactly.
Hey, David, I hear you saw the future of cinema that you're in film festival.
Oh, did I ever? On Friday night, I was at the first ever public screening of the world premiere of a film by Ang Lee called Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which I hear is five times as long when screened at a usual frames per second. But I saw it in the full shebang, as Ang Lee calls it, in one of only two theaters in the country that it will be equipped to screen it in this way, in 4K at 120 frames per second, in 3D with a zillion Lamberts of light, at Lincoln Square. Wow. What a night it was for cinema.
David, did you like the movie?
It's hard to say. I feel like I speak for almost to a person, everyone who was in the room that night. The 120 frame rates is such a frames per second is such a disaster, so distracting that while I have a pretty good sense of what I think of the movie, I don't know if I could say for sure because it's so distracting that it was impossible to get into the drama or really follow things from one frame to another. God bless Ang Lee, who, you know, is truly a visionary. And has one of the least likely filmmakers, I think, if you look at the films that he's made in the past, to really pursue this technology and make it the main thrust of the recent period of his career between this and Life of Pi and whatever boxing movie he's doing next, which James Sheamus tells me is going to change filmmaking as we know it.
Wow.
But he's a pioneer, and pioneers often die. And
what?
He's talking about like historical pioneers.
Yes. Shackleton.
Are you threatening Ang Lee's life?
Explorers. No, I would never wish. I don't think anyone would wish harm to come to Ang Lee. What a sweet man. But it's a real disaster. I mean, it looks, as anyone who saw The Hobbit in 48 frames per second could tell you, it looks like whenever anything is moving on screen, like you're watching it fast forward. And the sensation you had when watching The Hobbit is multiplied several times over here. But really what the 120 frames per second, the 4K, so on, gets you is a newfound clarity. It is there are shots, particularly when nothing is moving in the shot, and Ang Lee does his best to keep the camera as still and rigid as possible. You can see, you know, Steve Martin in 3D looking into the camera. You can see the bacteria forming in his pores, not just the pores themselves.
Ew.
I'm not saying that it's a pleasant sensation. Nobody benefits from this. But it is the myth of total cinema all over again, to go back to your Andre Bazin, you know, introductory to Film 101 reading, about how the closer we get to representing and duplicating reality on screen, the more inauthentic things can seem. It's an asymptote that you get closer and closer and closer in one degree, but never will get there. In fact, often get further away from what your brain believes to be a realistic picture. It's just not like the brain. 24 frames per second was not an accident. This is how our brains, our eyes, can speak to one another and interpret the film image on screen. And there is a reason that has become the norm. This is hyper-realistic to the point that it exposes ruthlessly all of the artifice that you see on screen. And so it not only from a visual standpoint, but it all the visuals feel so inauthentic, particularly when – like I could see this being a brilliant tool for documentary filmmaking, for sports, for
porn.
Yeah,
like would Planet Earth in 120 frames per second be mind-blowing?
Yeah, I think it could be at the very least. But the idea of scripted entertainment is what really throws a wrench into this, because the image is so clear and so quote-unquote lifelike that – it just exposes the artifice with such vengeance, really, that every syllable of a pre-written and memorized line or a movement blocking in the scene all just screams at you in a way that it's really difficult to judge the efficacy of drama or of a performance. I mean, it's a real testament to people like Kristen Stewart and the kid who plays Billy Lynn, who's never been in anything before, and the quality, even Garrett Hedlund, who's very good in the movie, of how realistic they can be. On the other side, Steve Martin, Chris Tucker in his first film since Silver Lining Playbook, I believe, and a number of other people don't benefit as much. But it someone had to take the risk, I suppose, because that's the age that we live in. I would not seek this movie out in this way And
so if you saw it, and it's like most people are going to see it on a normal screen, like, could it be good?
I think it could be interesting and very strange. I do not think that it could necessarily be good.
Man.
But yeah, it's a strange movie. It really does feel like, I mean, it's very reductive to say that it's a Flags of Our Fathers for the Iraq War. I think that the movie takes a slightly different tack than that, but any movie that climaxes with like a fake Destiny's Child halftime show where you see like fake Beyonce and fake Kelly Rowland and fake the other one from behind,
Michelle Williams,
it's just a strange movie, made all the stranger by the format in which I saw it the other night. A noble failure. It's not a noble failure. It's not an ignoble failure. It's just a failure. And I hope that, I don't know. I hope there's just a restlessness to creativity these days, that which can be good. It sounds good when it comes out of my mouth, but I don't know why this had to happen. I don't know why someone like Ang Lee couldn't see this coming, but.
Is there any evidence that other directors want to experiment with this frame rate thing? It really seemed like after The Hobbit, everyone had given up on the idea.
I think that James Cameron, and of course James Cameron,
yes.
Is...
Need another Avatar to thin out these ranks a little.
No, you need five more Avatars.
It's unfortunate because, you know, the one great advantage that all this technology gives is that the 3D, the main problem with 3D, other than how unnecessary it is and how unused it is in the movies we see, is that it's too dark. And this movie is so vivid. It's so bright. You feel with the Lamberts, the 4K, you don't feel like you have 3D glasses on in that respect. And that is a huge step forward. However, I felt the same way watching Avatar at 24 frames per second because James Cameron built that world from the ground up and was able to make Pandora that bright and that colorful and try to offset that. So, I don't know if that's enough to justify the experiment.
If James Cameron wants to do it, I'm in. I trust him. But
big surprise there. Katie wants to see a James Cameron movie.
I know. If he says I need five Avatars, I need five Avatars. But yeah,
you and I are going to be the only ones at Avatar 5.
I know. We're going to hang in there to the bitter end. But I guess I'll see Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, but you've given me zero interest in this new technology, which thank you for taking that bullet.
Got it, I'm the hottest around. They'll know when they see you rolling them polos around it.
I got a soldier.
With the top down, feeling the sounds quaking and vibrating your thighs. Riding harder than guys with the chrome wheels at the bottom, white leather inside. When them lanes be spitting at you, tell them don't even try to shoot it with Shell and kick it with Kelly.
So among the movies that are opening in wide release this week, including Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, David, would you go back?
When does this go live? This goes live on Tuesday. I am not allowed to say if I could never go back.
All right. So anyway, there's a bunch of movies opening wide release, and we're not going to talk about any of them. Instead, we're going to talk about Moonlight, which is opening in some limited release. It doesn't actually say how many screens. It's an A24 release. It's a big Oscar push for the company that won 3 Oscars last year, which might not be expected. It's from a director called Barry Jenkins, whose previous film, Medicine for the Melancholy, I'm pulling it
Medicine
right
for
now.
Melancholy.
Medicine for Melancholy was a kind of an indie hit, but on a really small level. Like, I heard of this movie existing, but it kind of had a pretty low profile. But, made this guy prominent enough that he's made
it's on Netflix
with A24.
If people want to watch it.
Yeah. So this is kind of, I think it's safely we say, be called his breakout feature. It's about one man told in 3 kind of separate stories in phases of his life. Once when he's in elementary school, maybe 10 years old or so. Once as a high schooler and then once as a young adult, kind of coping with everything that's happened in his youth up to that point. This movie, it premiered in the festival season, and this was when I was still on leave, so I'm a little fuzzy on the details. But basically, it seems from the minute people started seeing this, and maybe David, you saw it at Telluride. Were you at the beginning of the kind of incredible wave of buzz this movie's been riding?
I was before that, even.
What?
I know.
In true David fashion.
Early adopter David is what we call him.
I saw this movie before Telluride, and I did not have a particularly novel reaction to it, in that everyone I had spoken to had seen it before Telluride, knew that this was going to own that festival. And not just because Barry Jenkins has been involved in the Telluride Film Festival for years and has ushered there and lit Q&As and so on, and it's sort of like a second home for him. But it's one of those movies you see, and it's just such a fucking powerhouse that you cannot wait for other people to get into the conversation. You want to be there when it premieres just to see the look on their faces and feel the air sort of, in the room change and be excited and vibrate based on what's happening in this film. It's a staggeringly beautiful movie. I'm actually very, at this point, just because I think the reactions have been so euphoric at Telluride, at London, at Toronto, in New York. I'm excited to read and probably shake off the inevitable takedown pieces, and not the one from Armin White, which we all know is coming. But
oh man, he's going to say Mdia Halloween is better.
Yes, he is.
That's going to be his list.
But from the more erudite, engaged critics, I think that it's going to be very interesting, as it always is when you have a movie that's this beloved. I do think that Moonlight is a little bit more Teflon than a lot of the overpraised films that have come out of festival seasons in recent years. Should we say a little bit more about what the plot is? Or
sure,
yeah, because I assume most people are not up on the buzz or were there at Telluride right. when it screened.
Although I will say that if you watch the Moonlight trailer, is one of those beautifully cut trailers of the year, and it's also, to its credit, does a very, very good job of giving you the exact feel of the movie. It's rare that a trailer so honestly sells you on the film without necessarily giving anything away. This is a very difficult film to give anything away. It is not dependent on plot. It is essentially a story broken up into three segments, three times, in one man's life. You see him as a child and when he's, 7 or 8 or 10, whatever old he is, and then in high school, and then as a grown man, as he grows up in a rough neighborhood of Miami, the black man, son of a crack addicted single mother, who was taken under the wing of a local drug dealer who has a kind streak in him, a protective paternal streak. It was played by Marshall Ali, and his partner was played by Janelle Monáe, who is wonderful. Both of them are really, everyone in this movie is wonderful. And then you cut to high school where he starts to question his sexuality and he's always felt like he was a little bit different. He is growing up in a place where masculinity is pivotal to male identity, and male black identity in particular. And so this is difficult for him in high school when he develops, in a very elliptical Carol-esque sort of way, relationship with, another guy named Kevin. And, then in the third segment.
How is it Carol-esque? How is that Carol-esque?
The film's emotions, and how muted its approach is, its color palette, everything about it, right?
Carol drunk.
I wasn't gonna bust this out because I think I've already named or like privilege dropped enough on this episode. But Barry Jenkins tweeted me and he was like, "Yes, it is absolutely Carol meets Frank Ocean."
Wow,
I would disagree with the filmmaker.
I think it's totally healthy to disagree with the filmmaker, so I do not begrudge you that, even though you did corroborate that particular opinion of mine. But I think at the very least, describing it like that, even if you don't totally agree, can be a healthy way of getting anyone who gives a shit what I have to say about a movie into the door.
No, I mean, I think even if that doesn't really get to exactly what the movie is about, that it's accurate enough and intriguing enough that hopefully it should make people, you know, if they're not reading their reviews, Carol meets Frank Ocean, who doesn't want to see that?
I mean, there are definitely Americans who don't want to see that. Sadly.
There are many, many millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of fucking Americans who...
True.
Unfortunately, if we're going to be honest.
And don't want to see this movie. I do think that the Americans who do want to see this movie are going to be very, very glad that they did. It is a stunning piece of work. I cannot wait to see it again. It really... The last... Everyone... seems pretty much on the same page, just that the last third in mm-hmm. particular is extremely powerful. Andre Holland shows up. You might know him from The Nick. And if you don't know him from The Nick, watch The Nick. And he is, I think he might, I mean, there's so many contenders for best performance in this film. It's absurd. Literally anyone with a speaking part, and there are not that many of them,
I think that's astoundingly good to me. It's been a long while.
I think it's the standout.
It's been a long while since I've seen a movie where just all the performances seem really vibrant and lived in. But also, like, I would disagree with you. Your description of the movie early on, David, kind of painted as this kind of free-flowing, plotless, you know, observation.
It doesn't feel
that way to me. In fact, I think it has quite a bit of plot and drive and character and really granular moments, very specific acting beats that feel scripted, but in an important, profound, and observational way. And
I think it's symphonic. Yeah. It's not like drifty. I think it's symphonic. I mean, it has movements. You can, again, if you watch the trailer, the music that's in the trailer appears in the film, which helps, but like really just that constricting, swirling, like honing in on an emotion, on a repressed feeling. I mean, that is how the movie moves.
Yeah, and
I think that go ahead, sorry. Pat, nope. You haven't talked much about...
Go.
All right. So I was going to say, I think the extent to which it was plotted is where I maybe drifted off the movie a little bit. I think its middle section, without getting too much into plot, kind of relies on plot mechanics in a way that the rest of it doesn't, that felt a little less authentic to me, and not that I know a goddamn thing about life in a, you know, predominantly black Miami suburb, but... I felt like the mechanics kind of grinding a little bit, and I was kind of curious about where it was going to wind up. And then, David, as you said, the last third of the movie about the adult Chiron is incredible, and I was so back on board. But I do think as beautiful and as well acted and kind of enveloping as this movie is, there's the storytelling and kind of the way that the plot moves forward kind of it clinked a little bit for me sometimes.
Well, why? I mean,
I know.
maybe we have to kind of put our finger a little bit for the listeners about what. I mean, without spoiling, but as David said, nothing really feels like a spoiler here. But what is happening in these chapters, and why would you specifically point to the second one?
The first chapter, you're seeing this kid who's kind of just like this sensitive kid, and it's a lot about his relationship with his mother, who's played by Naomi Harris, who's addicted to crack, and then the drug dealer who takes him under his wing. And then when you meet him in high school, you kind of, David, you said he was kind of questioning his sexuality, and it's less that than everyone around him was kind of certain that he's gay and making fun of him for it. And he's kind of dealing with typical high school bullies. And I think the high school bully story maybe is so familiar from all different kinds of movies that when it appears in one that's this singular, it stands out a little bit more as feeling kind of less authentic than a lot of other parts of the story.
That's interesting. I thought the second middle chunk was really successful in skirting the tropes that you'd see in some, you know, films tackling the same subject. And because he's so certain of his identity and he's struggling not with discovering himself, but finding a way to express himself, but also he's alienated from this community from the get-go. He's not trying to blend in, really. He knows he's gay, and he's just trying to find someone he can confide in, which I think is really interesting, but also dealing with his mother, who's still on crack years later. And I don't know, the actor in that, Ashton Sanders, he's been in a few things, but I just found his kind of like muted, troubled, just like descending into darkness moment in this middle chunk to be really startling. And of course, he eventually gets to express himself a little bit. And that was really romantic and warm, and there's just so many colors both in the actual palette of the cinematography, which maybe borders on Instagram a little bit at certain times, but whatever, it's like it's colorful and it feels like real life, because a lot of real life we see is through that palette. And but then the colors of the emotions, the swirling essence of him and this guy that he meets at school and what they go through, and, you know, they rib each other because they're bros, but they're holding hands on the beach, and oh, there's just so many feelings, and they all seem to be, it's like synesthesia or something. You can
they're holding something at the beach.
Okay. No spoilers.
Spoiler.
Spoilers. But I don't know. I could see, I could detect, it was palpable, the feelings that they had, and it was coming through in the cinematography and the music and the movement. I don't know. That's, I found the middle section to be really successful. And the third is almost entirely set in a diner, right? It's almost a little play right there at the end, which is beautiful in its own right. But
the third section is kind of far-reaching. There's that bit where you see what he's up to now. There's the bit with his mother. There's the bit in the diner, and then more. There's a lot
going
on.
I guess that's true. People really seem to love the oldest Chiron. And he was probably, I didn't fall for him like I did the middle, the teenage kid, and then, of course, the younger, adorable kid. But you're right about Andre Holland, who comes back and is kind of a wise presence for this lost soul who, you know, has gone to a troubled path. High school left him in a bad place. But I like that he springs back, too. It's not a movie about him going down a dark path and dealing drugs and like whatever that world is. He enters that world and he becomes very successful, kind of like the mentors in his life in the first chapter. And there's a lot of back and forth and parallels and escaping the world that we've seen in the beginning. I don't know. It goes, you're always thinking about the previous chapters. And even in the beginning, you're thinking about where it could go. Like if he grows up and he's still on this course, you think about that. And then the movie pays off almost in advance. It's really dynamic.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite things I've seen in a movie this year is when you first meet Andre Holland as the older Kevin. There's just kind of this series of glamour shots of him leaning against the wall of the diner smoking a cigarette. And it's just this incredible, you know, they talk about the camera having a male gaze, and it's like the male gaze put on a man, which is something you so rarely see in movies. And it's so astonishing, and he's great in it. And another one of the ways in which this movie is really singular.
Dave, you haven't seen it.
I have not seen it yet.
No.
I have a question just based on describing. Is the middle sort of like Weekend?
No.
No.
Oh, man.
The middle is mostly set at high school.
Okay.
You know, with him getting into fights and really being... they are bullies, the people who come after him, but a lot more threatening just in terms of the violence that they suggest that they will visit upon him than like a high school bully type character.
Got it. Okay. The second,
did they make you feel the risk involved and the risk that one might feel of being gay, of embracing that side of your identity and sexuality in that area?
Sweet. Additional question. One of the things about Netflix's Luke Cage was I kind of felt like it did, you know, all of America's version of black culture. So, like, you could peek in on it and sort of pick out the parts that you didn't understand, but it wasn't, like, a deep dive into anything. Does this movie feel like a way to talk to people about black and gay culture?
Well, as a black gay man myself, I think that I am qualified to say that, I don't know if I know how to answer that. I do know that Barry Jenkins, for those out there who think that this matters, is not gay, but did grow up in Miami. His mother, I believe, did struggle with addiction. He did grow up in struggling economic conditions. So I think that a large part of this is meant to reflect his own experience in some respects. And it certainly trembles with the universal feeling, several of them, that they're not super specific to that. But I the best I can do to answer your question, and I'll pass it over to Katie and Matt, is that it does a great job of feeling specific without sort of feeling insular.
I think that's key. It's not that it feels autobiographical by nature. It feels, I think it'll get compared to Boyhood quite a bit over the next few months. And fairly so. I think Boyhood was very successful in capturing a point of view of particular ages and how you process the world and what you allow yourself to see, what you can get away with as a kid, as a teenager, as a real adult. But Boyhood did it in spurts, and here we get three prolonged sections. What is the childlike view of this Miami microcosm? And, you know, Chiron, as a young kid, kind of attaches himself to Mahershala Ali's Juan, who is a drug dealer, and he just seems like a mythic figure, and you feel it because you're seeing this world that doesn't make any sense through this boy's eyes, and it's sustained, and it can be easily disrupted. Like, he sees his mom on drugs, and that just blows his world back. And then, I don't want to give away this one scene, but there's this scene in the first section that I was just left bawling. I just really thought it was the most powerful bit of acting between this kid and Mahershala Ali that I had seen in many years. And it was a simple scene, and the revelations are, you know, not big, but they feel explosive in the eyes of this kid. And then, of course, it does it in the middle section, too, when he's keeping his secrets and he's standing away and he's trying to be part of this crowd, but he can't. And then he does it as an adult, as a really sheltered adult, because when you're an adult, you don't have to talk to anyone. You can do whatever the fuck you want. And I think that's really key. You get to choose your point of view when you get older, but in the beginning, you're kind of basking in this weird world.
This is a tiny thing, but there's something kind of magical about the way that the movie will kind of be really insular within a high school or within these housing projects where Chiron lives, or the school or a playground. And then it just opens up to the ocean because they're in Miami and the beach is just nearby. And it feels so expansive and exotic, but it's just kind of part of, you know, they have this like kind of rough, somewhat ugly surroundings, and they have the beach right there. And that to me was just like, oh, that's what growing up in a, you know, rough neighborhood in Miami is like. You just have that right there. I liked his boyhood was filmed in Texas, but didn't really feel specific to a place. And I liked how Moonlight felt really specific to a place.
So you wanted to go to the beach after seeing?
Yeah. I haven't been to the beach in a while, guys. Just take me to the beach.
Imagine if you Moonlight, just walk out of your house, go to the beach.
I know. So Moonlight is out this weekend on some number of screens. I'm guessing it's going to be one of those slow rollouts, but I assume you will be hearing plenty about it because...
Here in Denver, in the rest of America, we get it on November 4th opposite Doctor Strange. So I think that's where most people get it.
Choices.
That's perfect. One of the great things about award season, as much as we argue about it, is that movies like this get discussed for a long, long time. So you'll be hearing more about it and get more opportunities to see it.
I can't wait until it just misses getting nominated for Best Picture and we'd be mowing this entire stupid system.
You're still really working on your PTSD from Carol, aren't you?
I don't think you should be skeptical. I think it has a very good chance if we are opening that can of worms.
I think you're right. I thought Carol was a lock. And then my dreams were dashed. So
the biggest problem here, I was discussing with on Twitter, is that who is the lead performance of this and who is like a supporting actor?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
that's just going to be a clusterfuck.
I have stories to tell you about that off pod, pod, as they say.
Well, this is what the Screen Actors Guild Ensemble Prize is for, at least.
True.
You can push for that.
They're all the lead. That's what's wonderful about this movie.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. Like Jack Reacher, or unlike Jack Reacher, we are going back with another episode. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I am the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com. You can listen to the episodes, you can share them, you can leave comments, you can do it all. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. And you can find us all on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, G-A-7-E. That's also my handle on Twitter. Blog at geek.com. Do some long things at Thrillist.com, like that Godzilla piece we already plugged. And hey guys, Storm of Spoilers is now its own thing on the Wondery Media Network, which means no longer in this feed. You gotta go back, resubscribe to Storm of Spoilers if this was your way of getting it. But otherwise, it's nothing's going to change. You're just going to hear ads about food.
Sorry, I sneezed in the middle of your thing.
That's okay. It was a plug for a plug. It was not good.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, and I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. And Twitter is where you can also find all of us talking about politics sometimes and talking to you at F-I-T-W-R. And you can also tweet at us, and we'll retweet it, the answer to this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Jack Reacher, never go back. What is your least favorite Tom Cruise movie?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. Keep on surviving.